Marsha, will you call the next case?
Case number A18-1553.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal. I'd ask you, when you come to the podium, which you can raise or lower, there's a little button, depending upon your preferences, please introduce yourself so that we have that as part of our audio recording. If you have any questions about the procedure, feel free to ask me. And with that, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Bito, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Jason Orada. This is a case about the improper issuance of a 25-year harassment restraining order. The case boils down to two main issues. First, there's not sufficient evidence properly admitted in the hearing to support the issuance of the HRO. And second, if the court somehow finds that there is sufficient evidence, the appellant was denied a hearing as defined by and required under Anderson versus Lake. Speaking first to the sufficiency of the evidence, an HRO is a creature of statute and requires proof of harassment as statutorily defined under 609.748. The district court.
And in this case, in terms of that definition, I just want to focus on the language that I think applies here, and you tell me if I'm wrong. We'd be looking at repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the security, safety, or privacy of the victim in this case.
I believe that is what this court must look at based upon the facts.
Okay.
However, it seems to be the argument of respondent after reading respondent's brief that an HRO may be issued based upon the 2014 gross misdemeanor conviction incident without any further finding of more harassing conduct.
Does that matter? Does that argument matter, though, when you look at the court's order? It didn't rely on the 2014 incident. It relied on what I think is the wedding incident and then another incident where this person was at the bar across the street.
Absolutely right, and that's why I didn't address what became respondent's argument.
So why aren't those two incidents repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts that have a substantial adverse effect on the security of the victim here?
Absolutely. In this case, Your Honor, respondent challenged the issuance of the HRO, which then required the plaintiff to prove that there were at least two incidences of this harassing conduct that we're talking about. Moving to those two incidences, I guess, in order, the first incident, the court made findings that appellant violated two orders, once in 2015 and once in 2018. It's our position that there isn't sufficient evidence in the record proving that these two incidents actually violated any prior orders. But even if the court believes that there is, that neither incident actually qualifies as harassing conduct under 609.748.
Why not?
The first incident, I guess we'll talk about the so-called wedding incident. The court found that Mr. Orada attended a wedding, quote, near the Vesta address in July of 2015. This is unsupported by any testimony or evidence.
Well, didn't the victim in this case testify that she thought it was within 500 feet? They had measured, but
she did not. This is exactly what the victim testified to, her alleged victim, on page 8 of the transcript.
Okay.
Answer, then it was June or July of 2016. Court questioned, okay, tell me about that. Answer, he was within, I don't remember how many feet of my property. He was at the hall, which I don't know if they ever actually measured it. When law enforcement was contacted, they came to my property first, so Jason left because he knew why the cops were there. That's it. That's the entirety of the evidence in the record concerning this so-called wedding incident, which purportedly provides a basis for finding of this supposedly harassing act. There's nothing in this paragraph, and that's all it is. It's one paragraph.
And when you're saying a paragraph, are you talking about what you just read or the paragraph in the order?
I'm talking about what I just read.
Okay.
And that's the only evidence in the record, in the testimony, that would support this. There's no allegation that Ms. Bresson was in attendance at this wedding. There's no allegation that there's no explanation as to how Ms.
Does it matter if she was in attendance?
I think in this particular case it could. There's no explanation as to how Ms. Bresson became aware that appellant was at this hall. There's no evidence as to where exactly this hall was located. It couldn't be really any more vague. She says, I don't know how far it was away from my house. I wasn't there, clearly. There's no evidence that the appellant behaved in any sort of inappropriate way towards Ms. Bresson or anyone else. And certainly no evidence that his presence at the hall had a substantial adverse effect on Ms. Bresson's safety or security, or were intended to have such an effect.
So what I understand you saying is, even if we assume that that was a violation of the order, underlying order, that she has to come and show once again that it was conduct that constituted harassment.
Absolutely.
Fair to say? Okay. And so then I assume what you're saying is, well, if he was violating this training order, then this should really be a proceeding under Subdivision 6. And, you know, maybe it's a misdemeanor, maybe it's a gross misdemeanor, but that's not enough to prove, to get an extension of a harassment restraining order. I mean, I just want to make sure I'm following you.
That's absolutely right.
Why wouldn't a violation of harassment, I mean, you have, a judge has decided that there's a harassment restraining order to be in place. So it's found that there was harassment, there's enough to say, yes, there's a restraining order. That's not even appealed from. Then doesn't it make sense that a violation of that just almost implicitly would, a violation of that would cause I'm not sure victim's the right word, but the individual who had got the restraining order, you know, additional, you know, harm? Isn't that the reason the judge in the first place issued the restraining order?
I think in some circumstances it's certainly true that the violation of a harassment restraining order could constitute a new incident of harassment. I think that's absolutely true. I don't think, however, in a case like this, where the violation is a technical violation of a foot perimeter rule, or supposed violation, that per se constitutes harassment. The court still needs to find that there was a substantial adverse effect on her safety or security, or was intended to have such an adverse effect.
And it made that finding in the next paragraph or the next sentence. I mean, it checked the box that the harassment has or is intended to have a substantial adverse effect on petitioner's safety, security, or privacy. That's boilerplate language, obviously, and it's kind of hard to follow what the court's reasoning is. But why couldn't it have concluded that? Didn't she testify that, well, he keeps violating these, and that's the source of the insecurity?
I believe she made a blanket statement about that. But what we're talking about,
why wouldn't that support that conclusion then?
Well,
I mean, if we assume that it was a violation, and you've made the argument that it doesn't prove a violation, but if we assumed it was a violation, being within 500 feet, mm-hmm. why wouldn't that be enough to say that in conjunction with the additional one, she continues to be worried about it?
First of all, she's made these blanket statements about prior violations. I want to be clear that there has never been a criminal charge arising out of any of these violations.
Other than the first one.
That didn't arise out of any of these.
But not these two that we're talking about.
Correct. There has never been any sort of criminal charge arising.
Why does that matter? There's no requirement of that.
You're right. It technically does not matter. But there still needs to be sufficient evidence in the record showing that her safety or security was substantially impaired.
So isn't it enough when she testifies, having to do the two-year, every two-year, makes me, which is based upon the assumption there was a violation, makes me relive the assault and have to just go through everything again. It gets hard to move on with my life. Why isn't that enough to show that the violations of the harassment order had a substantial adverse effect on her.
What she's saying is she doesn't want to have to come back and argue that because of this assault back in 2014. I think that's what the respondent is arguing here as well, is that they're able to use this 2014 incident essentially in perpetuity.
If your client violates the restraining order.
Well, I believe their argument is they could come back every 2 years.
Well, is there anything in the statute that says that's incorrect? I mean, I don't see any sort of a statute of limitations type thing in the statute. It seems to me that just under the plain reading, that 2014 incident could be a basis for an order now, but that isn't what the district court relied on.
It is not what the district court relied on, and I think for good reason. There's a case, Rohr versus Dunham, 682 Northwest 2nd, 179. It's a 2004 case that actually Your Honor wrote. An HRO cannot be extended, and a new HRO cannot be based upon the same underlying incident or incidents that gave rise to a prior HRO. It must be based upon a recent events, not on the events which gave rise to the initial order. And this makes perfect sense. This is a holding from Rohr versus Dunham. Makes perfect sense after reading 609.748. A limit is placed upon the length of time that an order may be issued for, and there's no provision for extending that order. The only way to obtain a new HRO would be to bring an entirely new action, which must be based upon different events.
And isn't that what's happening here? The district court in this order isn't relying on the 2014 incident as a basis for concluding there was harassment. He's talking about these two violations.
What seems to be happening here is that the district court essentially skipped a step. It's true that if the court finds that a person has had two or more prior HROs against him, or if a person has violated an HRO on two or more occasions, then an HRO can be issued for up to 50 years. But before the court can get to that step, it must first find that harassment actually occurred in order to issue an HRO at all. In this case, the court skipped step one, found that there was violations.
But isn't that what the court does in paragraph one of the order? It checks the box that by the sentence, there are reasonable grounds to believe that respondent has engaged in harassment of petitioner by committing the following acts, and then describes the two acts as violations.
But there's nothing in the actual record that would support that any of these acts, by looking at them objectively, substantially impaired the safety or security of.
Okay, but that's a different question, whether the evidence is sufficient to prove
right.
It. My concern here is whether there has to be some new act. And I don't think we need to worry about whether that's what the law says, because the court really does cite two different acts than the initial 2014 assault. So you've got the argument that, well, the evidence doesn't support that these occurred or were violations. But now you're talking about something different, that even if we assume that these were violations, they don't rise to the level of being harassment.
Right. Even if the court finds that these are violations, the court still has to find that they fall under the rubric of harassment under 609.748.
And the court reaches that conclusion in paragraph 2, says that they do.
Right.
But your argument is that the evidence doesn't support that.
Exactly right. That the evidence that was properly admitted in the hearing, which is the requirement of Anderson versus Lake, does not support that court's finding. That's exactly right. We talked about the wedding incident briefly. The second incident found by the court is that appellant apparently went to a bar in Vesta across the street from a home owned by her father's estate. We don't believe that this violated any HRO in existence at the time, because the 2016 HRO was superseded by the July 2nd, 2018 HRO. This incident is alleged to have occurred on July 3rd. The July 2nd order did not preclude appellant from going to the bar across the street from the property. It simply said that he needed to stay away from the property itself.
Which one is that?
There's a July 2nd temporary order. Order issued July 2nd.
You're talking July 2nd, 2018.
2018.
Is there anything that says that the issuance of a temporary order ends the validity or the effect of the, an existing order?
Well, the existing 2016 order says that this restraining order is in effect for 2 years unless changed by a later court order. The later court order would be this July 2nd, 2018 order that changed the 2016 order. The 2018 July 2nd order simply stated he needed to stay away from the property itself. It did not give a radius. The 16 order said 250 feet, I believe. The 18 order simply said he needed to stay away from this 193 address.
18 temporary order.
Correct. 2018, the July 2nd order in 2018. We believe that that order superseded the 2016 order. But even if the court finds that the 2016 HRO was still in effect, which we don't believe it is, it's still not an incident that qualifies as harassment under 609.748. Ms. Bresson was not in the bar. There's no evidence that she was at her father's home. There's no evidence she was even in the state of Minnesota. Appellant did not direct any sort of act or speech against Ms. Bresson. The entirety of the incident was apparently relayed to Ms. Bresson by her boyfriend, who didn't testify. It's plain hearsay. Even if the court allows the hearsay of Ms. Bresson's testimony, her appellant's interaction with Ms. Bresson's boyfriend consisted of him sitting at the bar and asking her boyfriend, quote, "Hey, buddy, how's it going?" This is plainly not harassing conduct under 609.748.
So why couldn't the court, though, conclude that being at a bar across the street was not staying away from the property at 193 West Front Street? Why are those mutually exclusive?
They're not mutually exclusive, but that's not the test. The test isn't whether or not it was a violation of a prior order. The test is whether it's independently harassing conduct.
Right, but I'm looking at the two incidents that the court found happened, and I thought you were saying that the July 3rd incident didn't violate anything because the temporary order was the applicable order at that point.
Right.
And it just says, respondent shall stay away from petitioner's property at 193 West Front Street. You were saying it doesn't include any distance.
Right.
Which it plainly doesn't. But why couldn't the court consider being across the street from as not staying away from?
I guess the court.
It's ambiguous, but.
I guess the court could, Your Honor, but going to a bar across the street from the house without more is not objectively unreasonable conduct. And that's what the court is required to find, that it's objectively unreasonable conduct.
Okay.
Thank you. You have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thanks. May it please the court. Charles Nelson Ballard Spahr on behalf of Ripley Karen Bresson, the respondent in this case. So I think I just want to take it back a little bit. This is actually the third petition that Karen has submitted to the court, that the respondent has submitted to the court. Each one of the petitions was based on that 2014 sexual assault. And in each case, the court found the basis to issue the harassment restraining orders as the 2014 sexual assault.
That's not the case in the 2018 one. I mean, what language in there says this is based on that assault rather than on these two violations of prior orders?
Your Honor, I'll direct you to the order granting petition for ex parte, which was dated July 2nd, 2018.
Look at that now when we have a final order.
Well, so I'll give you two reasons. One, because he finds the basis for issuing the ex parte is that the appellant physically or sexually assaulted the petitioner. And two, the hearing was called, and I'll say in each of these three petitions, the appellant did not challenge any of the petitions. The appellant has never challenged the underlying basis for the issuance of a harassment restraining order. And then if you turn to the second page of the ex parte order, it states down in paragraph 3, the hearing is going to be held Because petitioner requested a restraining order for longer than 2 years, and the court wants more information about the need for a longer restraining order. And that's what this hearing is about. This hearing isn't about whether harassment has occurred. Harassment has plainly occurred. A single incident of sexual assault. Nothing in the statute provides any limitation on how long a victim of sexual assault would want to stay away from the perpetrator of that assault. No statute of limitations on the post-traumatic stress that someone would feel and suffer and need to have the protection of a harassment restraining order that the statutes allow. This hearing was about the length of time that the order could be in effect.
Right, but that isn't enough, is it? Under the statute, you have to have an order, a basis for an order, and then a separate determination whether it can be for more than 2 years.
And that's what this hearing was about, Your Honor.
So when you look at the order, though, the basis for the order in the first place is in paragraph 1.
I agree that the sexual assault is not included in the permanent order. I will point out that there are two different judges. There was Judge Dietrich, who entered the initial ex parte order, and then I'm blanking on...
Doesn't matter.
Okay, the two separate judges. And so, you know, I think there was some discussion at the hearing about that there wasn't a 200-foot radius applied to the Vesta property, and why was that? And the judge at the hearing said, well, I couldn't tell you why. So I think there might have been just some miscommunication and maybe some language wasn't carried over. But this hearing, based on the ex parte order, was clearly about the length of time that the order could be in effect. And that's all that...
Right, but so what? I mean, if the statute has the requirements that have to be met, the fact that you didn't address something that needed to be addressed...
Well, I think the statute also provides... Sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor. The statute also provides that... Let me pull up the statute. In subdivision 5... We're in subdivision 4, actually. Well, I guess I'd point you to subdivision 4, paragraph D. Temporary restraining order is in effect until a hearing is held on the issuance of the restraining order under subdivision 5. And I guess I agree that perhaps the permanent order was didn't carry over the findings of the why the order could be issued in the first place from the temporary order, and perhaps that is because there were two separate judges that were on the case. But I don't think that's reversible error to say that there's no basis for the issuance of the harassment restraining order. Your Honor, you look like you had a question.
Well, I'm just looking at the transcript of the proceedings, and the judge doesn't start this out by saying this is just about the length. It seems to be giving, actually, the appellant kind of the choices. You know, you can object or you can agree.
Your Honor, if you look at just the very first paragraph, page 3, 4 lines down. Judge Dietrich set today's date and time for a hearing because the temporary order issued a 50-year restraining order until July 2nd, 2043. In order to do that, a hearing needs to be set. So I think he did set the stage that this was about the length of time for the order. And that's all that the appellant challenged at the hearing, was the length of time and what distance he had to stay away from the Vesta property. So I believe actually appellant's biggest hurdle today is that many of the arguments he's making today are being made for the first time. They weren't made to the district court. He never challenged any of the petitions. Didn't challenge that the basis of a harassment restraining order could be the 2014 sexual assault. He didn't challenge that at the hearing. He's making that, this is the third petition, and he's making that argument for the first time here on appeal, that the 2014 sexual assault, which was the basis for the first harassment restraining order, the second harassment restraining order, and the ex parte restraining order, can't serve as that basis. And I haven't, because counsel just cited the Rohr versus Dunham case, I haven't reviewed that before, but I would I would guess, that that wasn't based on a sexual assault, and that was based on a series of lesser-type violations.
Why would that matter?
Well, I think because, again, Your Honor, I think there's a difference of a single incident of sexual assault and how that affects the victim and affects the person seeking the petition order versus a series of events that happened over 2 years ago and there's been nothing since. I could understand why there's a difference between those two parts of the definition of harassment and what can serve as the basis of a consecutive harassment restraining order. And so apparently there's some case law that multiple events of harassment that happened several years ago and haven't occurred again could not serve as the basis of a second consecutive harassment restraining order. But I think that the single incident of physical or sexual assault is different because of how the length of time, it's different for every person, how the length of time it would take to for that person to get over it and move on and be able to be in the same place with the person who perpetrated that sexual assault.
Yes, you're saying there that under the definition that the requirement of having a substantial adverse effect doesn't apply to the ones where they say a single incident.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the substantial adverse effect can last longer.
Okay.
That it's not unreasonable to assume that the substantial adverse effect of being sexually assaulted can last longer.
But this, as I understand it, wasn't about whether the adverse effect of the sexual assault lasted longer. It was whether there were, after the sexual assault, whether there were violations of the harassment restraining order. I thought this was being issued, but maybe I'm wrong. I thought you were saying under the subdivision 5 of 609.748B, and then there's a paragraph, I think it's, oh no, it's the paragraph under 3, I guess. A restraining order may only be issued, that paragraph, it says, or the respondent has violated a prior or existing restraining order on two or more occasions.
I think if you start reading the sentence a little bit before that, mm-hmm. If the court finds that petitioner has had two or more previous restraining orders in effect against the same respondent, which is true here. That is true here.
Okay, so that's what you're
That's the basis for why the 25 years is allowed here, because there were two prior restraining orders. So I think all the argument about...
And it's certainly easy to understand how that happened here, but that's not what the order says. Or that might have be what happened, but the order plainly doesn't base the conclusion of an order at all on the 2014 assault.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor, that the order doesn't clearly state... that it's based on the 2014 assault and that the 20... And he does, I mean, I think because of what the hearing was for, the judge was more focused on were there two incidences that violated prior restraining orders in the past. And those were the findings that he made. That was what his line of questioning at the trial was about. But I will point you to the transcript. If you look at... It's in the very beginning of the questioning... of the respondent, page 6, line 17. Okay, and just some background information. Those two prior restraining orders were issued after an incident on July 1st, 2014. Is that correct? And so he took testimony on the sexual assault incident that happened. I think in the record it's maybe July 2nd is actually when it occurred. So I do believe that the judge was basing the issuance itself on the sexual assault and then made the findings of violations of prior harassment restraining orders to justify the 25 years, when in actuality, he did it all right there. Line 14, or line 12, and you have two prior harassment restraining orders. Yeah. And that right.
One bar in Vesta?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there more than one bar in Vesta?
I don't know the answer to that. So anyway, with that, Your Honor, I do ask that you affirm the issuance of the temporary restraining order on the grounds that the trial court, there's sufficient evidence in the record to issue one, and that there were two prior restraining orders allowing for a time of 25 years.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Just moving quickly here, this argument that the appellant didn't challenge the issuance of the HRO and that this hearing was only about how long we could have the HRO for, I would turn the court to page 5 of the transcript. Line 15, the court says, okay, well, Mr. Arata, I'm still a little bit unclear about what you're challenging. Are you challenging the issuance of this order at all, or do you just want a reasonable distance from the Vesta property so you can still go to the bank? Answer, I'm challenging, yes, because of the 25 years and the address in Vesta. So this argument that everyone knew the hearing was just to decide, you know, how long we could have this order is not true.
Aren't there other statements in the transcript where he says, I don't intend to go buy this property or any of that?
I think it's clear that he doesn't.
But he's objecting to not being able to do it for 25 years.
He's objecting to the order at all because of the length of time and because of what it doesn't allow him to go to certain places in this small town of Vesta. And so this argument that he's not challenging the order isn't true. The plaintiff had the burden of proving harassment under 609.748.
What is it in the response that you just presented from the transcript that would inform us that he's challenging the substance, the basis for the order?
When the judge says, are you challenging the issuance of this order, or do you just want a reasonable distance from the Vesta property, he says, I'm challenging, yes. That's in response to a question.
I'm challenging what? Yes.
Well, the judge's question was, are you challenging the issuance of this order?
Well, it was disjunctive. Are you challenging the issuance of the order, or?
He doesn't use the word challenging again. He says, do you just want a reasonable distance? Mr. Arata.
Right, so it's either or. And so there's a challenge to what? We don't know. I'm not sure that exchange clarifies that there is a challenge to the substance, the basis for the order. Is there something else in the transcript that would inform us that your client was challenging the underlying basis for the issuance of the order?
I think unless the court actually gets the defendant to agree to the issuance of the order on the record, which didn't happen here, I think we have to assume that the plaintiff has a burden to prove that harassment occurred.
Well, what else is there in the transcript that would inform us that?
I think it's the absence of an explicit agreement that the order would be allowed to go into place. There's no agreement by my client that the order would be allowed to turn into a permanent order from an ex parte temporary order. And I think the person who they want to get the order against doesn't explicitly agree to that, then the burden is on the plaintiff to prove up facts that would allow the judge to impose this under 609.748. I want to very quickly move to my second argument that if the court does find sufficient evidence that the hearing did not comply with the requirements of Anderson versus Lake, the court in this case took total control of the hearing and conducted all of the questioning. The court first questioned Ms. Bresson. When the questioning was complete, the court said to appellant, what would you like to tell me? The court didn't say, okay, Mr. Arata, now you may ask relevant questions of Ms. Bresson concerning these incidents, or do you have any questions for cross-examination, or anything of the sort. By immediately going into the questioning of the appellant, the court effectively foreclosed any opportunity for the appellant to cross-examine Ms. Bresson about these incidents. We don't have a good record here, frankly, because there was no cross-examination about any of these incidents.
But is there anything that says the court has to do that?
Well,
You're not entitled to have, or you're entitled to have a lawyer if you want, but the hearing can go forward without a lawyer. There's no prohibition of that.
Absolutely. But what the court has to do is provide an opportunity for cross-examination. And that's what the facts were in Anderson versus.
And what does that mean, though?
It means the court has to say something like, okay, Mr. Arata, would you like to cross-examine Ms. Bresson? Or now's the time when you can ask Ms. Bresson questions. Instead, the court immediately went into the direct examination of Mr. Arata without giving any opportunity for him to, you know, ask her any questions that would test the veracity or truth, which is what cross-examination is all about. The court had a duty when dealing with these pro se litigants to make sure that the hearing provided the safeguards guaranteed by Anderson versus Lake, and the court didn't do so. Adding to the problem, when appellant asked about the possibility of hiring an attorney, the court says, essentially, you have a right, says you have a right to do that, but it's too late. That's what the hearing is for today. Now, it might have been within the court's power to deny a continuance and allow him to hire an attorney, but this refusal to continue it for an attorney, plus the court's failure to
provide... Well, there was no request for a continuance.
There wasn't, but he asked for an attorney, and the court said, you're too late. This, plus the court's failure to provide an opportunity for appellant to cross-examine Ms. Bresson, along with the court's allowance of blatant hearsay into evidence, requires this court to remand the matter. If the court's not going to reverse, the court must remand the matter for a true hearing as delineated by Anderson versus Lake.
Any other questions? Any other questions?
Your Honor, if I had some time left, could I...
No, that's not how it works. We appreciate the effort, and we appreciate the briefing and the argument.
You can save that time for your next argument. Mention that you've got it in the bank. That might work.
That's not how it works either.
We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days.
Thank you.
Our next matter is on ITV, so while that's getting set up, the court will be in a short recess.